So next Friday and Saturday, Friday evening and Saturday till about 2 o'clock, we will have here in our sanctuary the Bishop John Selby Spahn. He served as the Episcopal Bishop of New Jersey, Newark, New Jersey, for many years until he retired. And Bishop Spahn is a leading spokesperson in the world for enlightened Christianity. If you would like to attend and hear the bishop, you can sign up at our church website. The cost is a modest $60, and that includes food. When Bishop Spahn visits us next weekend, and if you're able to come and hear his religious views, his liberal religious views, perhaps one of you will be tempted to go up to the bishop and say, "Reverend Spahn, you are so liberal, so progressive, why don't you convert to Unitarian Universalism?" I don't know what he'll say to that. Perhaps, though, he might say that he loves the rituals of the Episcopal Church, including the beautiful processionals at the start of Episcopal worship as the choir and the clergy march in through the center aisle. And some joke that liberal Episcopalians are really Unitarians who like parades. Now, here in our community, we have lapsed Episcopalians, along with former members of other traditional denominations. We like to think that our use of reason, logic, our use of the scientific method in evaluating religious claims has attracted them to join our congregation. About 88% of Unitarian Universalists have left other more traditional religious movements to join ours. We have become accustomed to thinking of Unitarianism as a religion that people join after becoming unhappy with more traditional religions in their childhood. We assume that as people become more educated, they will seek us out. Well, this morning I'd like to tell you about a man who did exactly the opposite. As a child, his father immersed him in Unitarianism. His grandfather was the Reverend William Greenleaf Elliott, who founded the first Unitarian Church in St. Louis, as well as Washington University. His mother and father had baptized the child in his grandfather's Unitarian Church. His whole family was immersed in Unitarianism. He had a younger cousin, Thomas Lamb Elliott, who was a member of my Unitarian congregation when I served a church in Bethesda, Maryland. And I officiated at Thomas Lamb Elliott's memorial service in 1999. They were devoted to Unitarianism. Three different members of the Elliott family served as presidents of the American Unitarian Association. There was Thomas Dawes Elliott, Samuel Atkins Elliott, and Frederick May Elliott. Yet, as an adult, Thomas Stearns Elliott abandoned Unitarianism. Having left us for the Church of England, Elliott is one of the few people we consider a heretic. He was born September 26, 1888. His father was the president of the Hydraulic Press Brick Company. He encouraged his son to have high expectations of achievement and to live up to the family standards of success. Father and son were not close. Tom was the last of seven children, and his father was in his 40s when Tom was born, and he was growing deaf, I guess, from working at the Hydraulic Press Brick Company. Father placed great emphasis on the importance of work and achievement, so he was often away from home at his own work. In spite of the distance between them, as an adult, Elliot achieved success in business, following after his father, doing what he thought his father would have wished him to do. Elliot's mother was a former school teacher who had a deep respect for writing and books. She was not particularly interested in babies, but after the stage of early infancy passed, she enthusiastically nourished the intellectual development of her young children. His mother loved literature, and she encouraged her son to learn to read and to use the family library. In his childhood, in addition to his mother, other women were also important. He loved his nurse, who cared for him from the day he was born. And when he was not in her care, his four older sisters were also there to care for him. The older sisters provided a protective and comforting childhood to their little brother. As an adult, Elliot attempted to recreate this comfort and support in his first marriage. At an early age, Elliot learned from his family to control his emotional life. They told him to keep his feelings to himself, to remain rational, orderly, and self-contained. They raised him to dress, to think, and to behave correctly. They taught him to practice control and restraint of his impulses and his appetites. At an early age, his family impressed on him that buying candy was an example of a needless self-gratification. As a result, throughout his life, Elliot never bought sweets. As an adult, he stood nearly 6 feet tall but weighed only 137 pounds. Dressed in pinstriped banker suits, friends described him as aloof, cold, reserved, secretive, shy, timid. An old joke says that Unitarians believe in the brotherhood of man in the neighborhood of Boston. Now, in keeping with this view, Elliot left St. Louis, and at 17, he entered Harvard. The president of Harvard was his third cousin, William Elliot, a staunch Unitarian. Unitarianism in 1905 believed in progress through science and reason. Turn of the last century Unitarians believed that human life was on the verge of great advances in which science, reason, education, and democracy were going to eliminate poverty, hunger, war, and sickness. Unitarians sang, as we did this morning, "These things shall be a loftier race than e'er the world hath known before." They sang, "Wonder still the world shall witness, never known in days of old," which will be our closing hymn. They did not talk about sin or tragedy or evil. They talked of progress, efficiency, and well-being. It was a positive view of life that dominated Elliot's youth. Elliot had a highly developed intellect, but he had not developed what we now call emotional intelligence. He was shy in social events. He immersed himself in a world in which he felt comfortable, a world of lectures at Harvard, reading books at the library, and studying. He completed his bachelor's degree in only 3 years and his master's in English literature in his fourth year. He was intelligent, but also reserved, detached, and bookish. The anxiety of his isolation caused him to discount the popular romantic poetry of the time. Instead, he read Dante's Divine Comedy, and he studied Sanskrit and Buddhism. He began to experiment with writing poetry that juxtaposed the commonplace and the symbolic, poetry that used abstract language, poetry that employed shock and surprise. His words portrayed the loneliness of his existence, the loneliness as seen through the eyes of a shy young man. So the young, timid poet composed a poem he called The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock. It began this way. Let us go, then, you and I, when the evening is spread out against the sky like a patient etherized upon a table. Let us go through half-deserted streets, the murmuring retreats of restless nights in one-night cheap hotels and sawdust restaurants with oyster shells, streets that follow like a tedious argument of insidious intent to lead you to an overwhelming question. Oh, do not ask, what is it? Let us go and make a visit. It goes on like that. He returned to Harvard to work on an advanced degree in 1911. The family hoped that the boy would become a professor of philosophy. But in 1914, he accepted a fellowship to study at Oxford University. And it was in England that T.S. Eliot was reborn. He met Ezra Pound, an eccentric young American poet, who introduced him to other young writers and encouraged Eliot to write and publish. Pound came to believe that Eliot was the greatest living poet in the world. He met Vivian Haight, an adventurous, vivacious young English woman. She was attracted to him because he was good-looking, quick-witted, and a poet for whom friends predicted a great future. Shy young Eliot was intensely attracted to this woman who was full of life. 3 months after they met, they were married. Lacking money, the newly married couple accepted an invitation to stay with another new friend, Bertrand Russell, the philosopher. Russell helped Eliot in his career and had an affair with Vivian. He told Eliot that Vivian was mentally unstable and a danger to herself and others. Later in life, Eliot wrote about the frightening nature of choice, how some decisions are irrevocable and can lead to a lifetime of misery. Such was the case with his marriage. Bertrand Russell was correct. Vivian was physically and emotionally ill, and Eliot found himself in the role of her nurse and guardian. To pay his bills, Eliot accepted a minor position in Lloyd's Bank. Uriah Pound and Bertrand Russell encouraged him to leave the bank so he could devote all his time to writing poetry. But Eliot stayed at Lloyd's for 8 years and received several promotions. Remember, his father was a businessman. His father, who died in 1917, would have approved of his son's success as a banker. In the evenings, he tried to work on his writing, but Vivian required constant care. She suffered from migraines, tiredness, and depression. Doctors tried many different treatments, including prescribing morphine and ether as a treatment. To calm himself, Eliot himself began to drink and to smoke. In 1921, his mother came from St. Louis with one of his older sisters, came to London to visit. Eliot spent weeks showing him London, trying to put the best face on his troubled marriage, while working full-time at the bank. A few days after his mother and sister departed, he began to experience severe headaches. A London doctor told him he had to get away at once, and the bank gave him 3 months' leave. He departed to receive treatment from a doctor in Switzerland. During this period of pain and depression, Eliot completed a new poem. and on leaving Switzerland, he arranged for its publication. Today, many English professors regard The Wasteland as one of the most important poems of the 20th century. It began this way. April is the cruelest month, breeding lilacs out of the dead land, mixing memory and desire, stirring dull roots with spring rain. It was published in England and America in 1922, and the poem struck a common chord of feeling in both countries. Bookstores sold 12,000 copies in a short time, a matter of months. Undergraduates, young intellectuals, memorized and chanted the poem. Eliot had popularized a new style of poetry. Positive reviewers interpreted the poem in several ways: as a personal autobiographical poem, as an account of collapsing society, and as a Buddhist meditation. Detractors wrote that the poem was simply a literary game. I like Conrad Aiken's description. He said that the poem The Wasteland succeeded by virtue of its incoherence, not of its plan, by virtue of its ambiguities, not of its explanations. The cold, hard images, the rhythmic passages, the pessimism and futility in the poem, it all resisted interpretation, but left people with a strong feeling. It was 1922. Eliot was 34 years old. Suddenly, he was a famous person. To compare him to someone in our time, he would be like the way we all know who Bob Dylan is and know some of his great songs. He was a celebrity in the 1920s in England and America. He later said that year of The Wasteland marked the beginning of his adult life. The painful relationship with Vivian continued to drain his energy, his time, and his financial resources. He quoted a line from Yeats, William Butler Yeats: "We begin to live when we have conceived life as a tragedy." But slowly, Eliot began to climb out of his own personal tragedy. In 1925, he left the bank to accept a position as an editor and publisher. This work combined his business skills with his love of writing. It would be a step towards happiness. In 1927, in secret, he joined the Church of England, leaving behind his Unitarian roots. But he admitted privately that he held his beliefs with a skepticism of which he never expected to be free. The structure and the devotional discipline of the Church of England drew him to the ritual. He found peace of mind in the communion he made, and he made a point of attending Mass at a church in London twice a day. It was a step towards happiness. And also in 1927, Eliot became a British citizen. He said, "Here I am making a living, enjoying my friends here. I don't like being a squatter. I might as well take full responsibility." And this also was a step towards happiness. Then in 1933, Eliot left Vivian. With the help of friends and the advice of Anglican priests, he came to the painful conclusion that to maintain his own emotional health, he must separate from his wife. It wasn't a divorce, but just a separation. They remained legally married. For him, it was a step towards happiness. Vivian herself never healed. In 1938, her brother committed her to a private mental hospital. When Eliot heard of her death in 1947, he buried his face in his hands and cried. His feelings of sadness over his first marriage haunted him for years. In the poems Eliot wrote in these years, he struggled to translate his personal and private journey into universal language. Just before leaving Vivian, he wrote the poem Ash Wednesday. "And I pray to God to have mercy upon us, and I pray that I may forget these matters that with myself I too much discuss, too much explain. Because I do not hope to turn again, let these words answer for what is done, not to be done again. May the judgment not be too heavy upon us." The years after 1933 became increasingly happy and productive. He wrote and published the poems called The Four Quartets. He wrote several plays, including Murder in the Cathedral and The Cocktail Party. In 1948, the Swedish Academy honored Eliot with the Nobel Prize in Literature. Eliot seldom made jokes. He was not a man known for his sense of humor, but he did like to tell a story about the event of receiving the Nobel Prize. He was leaving Stockholm to receive the prize, leaving for Stockholm to receive the prize, and an American reporter at the airport in London came up to him and asked him, "Mr. Eliot, what book did they give you the Nobel Prize for?" He replied, "I believe it's given for the entire corpus." "When did you publish that?" the man wanted to know. Well, Eliot was fond of detective stories, Agatha Christie, Sherlock Holmes. He could quote passages from Sherlock Holmes from memory. And after the encounter with the reporter, he said that he wanted to write a mystery novel that he would call The Entire Corpus. In 1957, at the age of 68, T.S. Eliot picked the romantic setting of his publishing office to propose marriage to his 30-year-old secretary, Valerie Fletcher. She was delighted to accept. In keeping with Eliot's wish for secrecy and privacy, they were married in the church at 6:15 a.m. on a January morning in 1957. In the years after the marriage, friends said Eliot's nervous appearance, his look of illness, all of that vanished and was replaced with the light of joy in his eyes. He declared that he had been happy only twice in his life, during his childhood growing up in St. Louis and during his second marriage. After 8 years of bliss, the poet died of natural causes on January 4th, 1965. His partner, Valerie Fletcher Eliot, lived until 2012. What can Unitarian Universalists learn from T.S. Eliot's life? As an Episcopal bishop comes to visit us next Friday and Saturday, what might we learn from the Anglican and the Episcopal Church? Trusting in the progress of science, optimistic American Unitarians can sometimes neglect the tragedy in human life. In contrast, Eliot experienced from London the destruction of the First World War and then the conflict of his first marriage. The Anglican Church's recognition of pain and suffering, which is symbolized by the death of Jesus on the cross, this spoke to him. Trusting in reason, Unitarians value intellectual sermons, not rituals like communion. In contrast, the daily structured rituals of the Anglican Church gave comfort to Eliot during a time when his private life was in emotional chaos. While we trust in hard evidence, We are rational Unitarians. We are skeptical of religious mysticism. But in contrast, the ritual, the music, and the prayer of the Anglican and Episcopal Church offered Eliot hints of the eternal, what he called in one of his poems, the still point of the turning world. The reality of suffering, the comfort of ritual, the openness to mysticism. These the Anglicans offered Eliot, and they inspired his poetry. They inspired his description of God and the eternal. He wrote, "At the still point of the turning world, neither flesh nor fleshless, neither from nor towards, at the still point, there the dance is. At the still point of the turning world, neither flesh nor fleshless, neither from nor towards, at the still point, there the dance is."